To introduce this episode of An American Gallery, here is the noted American entertainer, John Bubbles.
You know, I think about it every once in a while. That September night in 1935, I was at the Colonial Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. They played the overture, the curtain went up, and for the first time, an audience was seeing George Gershwin's American opera, Porgy and Bess. It's kind of hard to believe, but most of you weren't even born that night over 30 years ago. And it's just as hard to believe that my role of sporting life made me a part of something that has every promise of becoming downright immortal. I guess it really all started in 1898 when a Jewish couple in Brooklyn named Morris and Rose Gershwin became the parents of a boy named George. Those folks didn't know an A-flat from a tenement flat. And yet there George grew up to be the genius who wrote the music for Porgy and Bess.
George Gershwin, composer, saluted this week on An American Gallery. Ross Martin stars as George Gershwin in Porgy, Bess, and George.
The Supreme High Command of the Third Reich can today announce to the people of Denmark another glorious victory for the fatherland.
It ain't
our plans are to be moved forward on the Eastern Front.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't never ever this song.
In 1943, during World War II, Porgy and Bess had its European premiere in Denmark. All of the 22 performances were sold out, and the critical and popular acclaim of the Danes was unstinting. This American folk opera became a symbol of Denmark's resistance to the Nazis. Each time the Nazis issued their victory communiques over the Danish radio, the underground cut in with their precious recording of one of the opera's most popular tunes. It ain't necessarily so. It's virtually impossible to find anyone who doesn't know at least some Gershwin music. Not a day goes by without Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue being played or performed somewhere. He wrote that in 1924. He was 26 years old. In 1925, he composed his Concerto in F. And in 1928, American in Paris. But for him, these were merely preludes to Porgy and Bess.
I'm coming!
Get the light out!
Get the coffee on.
Well, now, which is it?
Huh?
You want the lead out or the coffee on?
Both.
My pot refuses to perk before 11 a.m., my dear brother.
Well, I'll coax it. Sun is high and there's a world to conquer, Ira.
You've already done that, George.
You ever read, Ira?
Only my own lyrics.
Well, we all have our crosses to bear. Here.
Hey, that's Mama's China you hit. You want to die before your time?
That is DuBose Hayward's novel, Porgy.
George, you gave me a copy of this about 4 years ago.
I also told you then it was a perfect vehicle for my opera. How do you like this Victorian stove?
With a match. Only composers can afford pilot lights. Here.
Read it.
Closed box before striking, manufactured by the Diamond Match
Company. Not that, the book.
I saw the play. 1927, remember? The Theater Guild produced Porgy.
That's 5 years ago. Ira, this is a magnificent thing. Hayward has treated the Negro with dignity and intelligence. His characters aren't stereotypes out of Hollywood. They're real. My music, your lyrics, and Porgy can be an American opera that will endure.
Your supreme accomplishment.
Well, you said it, not me.
George, you've known the work for 5 years. Did you have to wake me up?
Because
at this...
I just woke up. It just dawned on me. This is exactly the vehicle I've been looking for.
The story of a Negro beggar from Catfish Row in Charleston?
Yeah, I already wired Hayward. He owns the rights free and clear. Will you read it?
George, you have a dozen other commitments.
I always have a dozen other commitments, but this will be uppermost in my mind. The mood, the setting, the characters, they all have to move inside of me. And that's what has to happen with you. It takes time. This isn't Lady Be Good, Ira. It's an opera.
All right. I'll read it.
Finally.
Arguing with you is like arguing with Mama. I never win. And I'm always glad.
Summertime, 1934. For the first time since the Gershwins planned their collaboration with Porgy's author, DuBose Hayward, 2 years before, George was free of his many commitments. He packed his bags, grabbed the first train for South Carolina, and soon found himself heading for Hayward's summer home on Folly Island.
DuBose, you mean to tell me this motorboat is the only way to reach your place?
Heck no, could have swum there. This'll do you good. You got a little of that subway pallor.
Yeah, complicated by a slight touch of opening night jitters.
Yeah, there's the Haywood Cottage. We'll tie up right by it.
Swell, when do the natives attack?
I guess it is all kind of primitive by your standards.
Yeah, but DuBose, watch it. Over there.
What?
Not 20 feet from us.
Oh, hey, you really are a dude. That's just a giant turtle burying some eggs.
Oh. you mean they're friendly?
A lot friendlier than those sharks out there.
Where?
You see their fins?
We just came through there.
Safer than Penn Station in the rush hour.
Oh, boy, if you know anybody who wears a size 34 bathing suit, I brought one they can have.
Save it. You can use it to swat away the sand crabs that'll be crawling around the cottage I rented for you.
Sand crabs?
Yeah, and maybe you can sing Embraceable You to some of the bull alligators in the swamps over yonder.
Did anybody happen to line up a piano for this safari?
You know, George, the missus even went and had it tuned for you yesterday.
Oh.
Here, give me a hand. Let's keep it up the luggage. It's only a couple of 100 feet to the cottage.
Nothing personal, DuBose, but as a respected American author, I can't understand why you chose to live on a battered South Sea island. You have to admit it sure looks like one.
I'll admit it is a little ragged around the edges. We had a hurricane 2 weeks back.
And Ira was griping because he had to stay in New York to put the final touches on Life Begins at 8:40.
You know, it's the warm days that get you. When the flies, gnats, and mosquitoes come hunting for your blood. I hope you can compose with one hand, because you'll be scratching with the other.
Listen, could we stop at your place, maybe, so I can phone my mother? She worries if I go south of 34th Street.
Telephone?
Mm-hmm.
Not a single one on the whole island.
You mean it's 10 miles through shark-infested waters to the nearest phone?
Wonderful, isn't it?
Oh.
Yeah. Here we are. Your cottage. How do you like it, George?
This place called Folly's Island or Devil's Island?
Four rooms.
Running water?
Run...
On this island, George, running water's the name of an Indian brave. We bring in our water in 5-gallon crocks from Charleston.
Where's the closet?
Right here.
4 nails?
Hmm? More, where those come from.
Oh, thanks.
You know, some folks say Jefferson Davis slept in that bed.
Yeah, after he lost the war, no doubt.
Hmm. Here, come in here. There.
Oh, I don't believe it.
Try it. I reckon I should have warned you, but you were so intent on working near the atmosphere that inspired the story.
Yeah, maybe so, but only because you just didn't want to come to New York, that's all. And that's where we worked out the song that should be this island's anthem.
Yeah, what's that?
And nothing's plenty for me.
Well, that tune still sounds good.
It better. If my music and your and Ira's lyrics won't hold up for 2 months, we're in trouble.
How does that stuff look that I've been sending you?
Every bit as good as I hoped. Ira thinks so, too.
But does it bother him, collaborating with me on the lyrics?
Who, Ira?
Hmm?
Oh, sweetest disposition this side of my father.
Hmm.
Me? I have my mother's disposition. And nothing you've done bothers me.
Except
too much dialogue.
Still?
We're doing an opera,
DeBose. But if the dialogue is fast-moving, cut to the bone, this will give the opera speed and tempo. The singing has to grow out of the action.
DeBose, your dialogue already sings. Look, I'll show you. Here, your manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
Go on, open it anywhere. Go ahead. Right. Pick a line, any line.
All right, here. Hush, little baby, don't you cry.
Oh, now that's too easy. Just listen. So hush, little baby, don't you cry.
See? I believe the word is touche.
Oh, yeah. Now, the opening of Act 2, where Jake sings with the fishnets. I love your lyric ideas, but the rhythm completely eludes me.
Well, George, if you just imagine yourself at the oar of a boat.
Oh, swell.
I keep forgetting. All right, let's grab the lyric. We'll get in the boat. You'll start rowing, and you'll hear the rhythm.
It takes a long pull to get there. It takes a long pull to get there. It takes a long pull to get there.
Except for Hayward's one short visit to New York the previous April, that summer was the first time the two men actually worked together. All their earlier work had been carried between New York and South Carolina by the United States mails. But now Gershwin was free of his numerous commitments, and work on the folk opera accelerated, often to the accompaniment of the alligators in the nearby swamp. Gershwin saw his 7-week stay on the South Carolina coast as an opportunity to observe the very people who were the principal characters in the folk opera. At every opportunity, he and Hayward visited the neighboring Negro communities.
This is James Island, George. Mostly Gullah Negroes here.
Gullah Negro?
Mm-hmm.
Never heard the word.
Toss me that line, will you?
Oh, sure.
The Gullahs settled the coastal islands of this state, Georgia, and some of Florida. Their accent is more English than American.
That's fascinating.
That's the church right over there. Come on.
Hey, we're not too late, are we?
No. Services will still be on. And I guarantee you a full house. SRO. And when they sing, George. Well, if you can capture some of that spirit, you'll have your folk opera.
You know, DeBose, when I started work on the music, I decided against the use of original folk material.
Why? It's marvelous stuff. Most of the world's never heard it, and it's as American as hot dogs and Indian rain dances.
Yeah, but the music has to be all of one piece. I have to write my own spirituals and folk songs.
And where do you find the inspiration? on Broadway?
All right. Maybe I have a little egotism, but I'm not a fool. I had a reason for swapping the racket of a midnight traffic jam for those loud-mouthed crickets outside my cottage. I'll write the music, but I know the inspiration's down here. That's what excites me so about the whole project. The humor, the superstition, the religious fervor, the dancing, all the irrepressible high spirits of the American Negro never appeared in operatic form.
Or any form, for that matter. Except for jazz, and that's a hybrid.
Mm.
You'll never hear Beiderbecke or Armstrong at a revival meeting. But the way you keep cutting dialogue, how are you going to get away with the word opera?
Well, it's a new form, opera combined with theater. And can you tell me a better people to use as characters in this form? I don't know of anyone who expresses himself more eloquently by song and dance. And we need their humor, DuBose. It's part of our American expression. I don't mean gag humor. I mean natural humor. Mm. Humor that flows from the story itself into the lyrics and the music. If I can only... Listen. Listen to that.
I am.
In Act Two.
Mm-hmm. You wanted to open that with a prayer.
Let's see, Scene Three ends with Porgy promising to protect Bess. The duet, I Loves You, Porgy. The hurricane bell sounds. It's perfect. A hymn, a prayer, it's perfect to open Scene Four. All of Serena's friends are terrified. They're in her room praying for their men out at sea during the storm.
I like it.
And now, listening to this, I know how that prayer's got a sound, DuBose. I can hear it, I tell you. I can hear it.
Summertime 1934 flew by for Gershwin. He completed most of the monumental score in the 42 days he spent with DuBose Hayward. He had faith in the work. He saw it as resembling a combination of the drama and romance of Carmen and the beauty of De Meistersinger. He felt the dramatic effect would be sensational, for he planned to have the few white people in the production speak their lines, while the Negroes, in answering, would sing theirs. Both Ira and Hayward worked on the lyrics. Gershwin returned to New York in August, and on November 5th, wrote to Hayward.
I would like to set a tentative date for rehearsals. Also, I would like to have auditions started during January or February so the people we cast can be learning the music, saving us much rehearsal time. Now, Ira has written the lyrics for Porgy and Bess' first duet, and I really think this bit of melody will be most effective. As soon as I finish this letter to you, I'm going over to play it and sing it. Lawrence Tibbett, I'm not. For my editor at Chappell's Music Publishers. Doc Sermey is an old friend of mine, and his taste is impeccable. So, my regards to the alligators, and step on a sand crab for me.
George, you know why you came to see me?
Please, no philosophy. I need a reaction.
A drink?
Oh, thanks. Just a piano.
I have more pianos than Minsky has girls. Come.
You know, I think I've done something really good, Doc.
That's why you've come.
What?
For all your ego, which your success entitles you to, you're not as confident as you'd pretend.
What are you talking about? I just said it's good.
You think you've done something good, remember?
Doc, you're losing me.
I'm simply saying that your talent is so great because you never forget that without the favorable opinions of others, talent can't exist. The greatest act in the world would be nothing without applause.
Doc, you're getting old.
Deny it. You came for my approval, my applause.
You're crazy. Porgy's going to be great.
Aha, then why are you here?
My piano's out of tune, okay?
Okay, okay. Go ahead. What have you got? Play.
It's the first duet between Porgy and Bess. Now, Ira did the lyrics. I'll do Porgy's part first. And then Bess's.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
you must laugh and sing and dance for two instead of one. Want no wrinkle on your brow. No how? Because the sorrow of the past is all done, done. Real happiness is just begun. And she sings to him, and she says, Porgy, as your woman now, eyes, and you...
Doc? Doc?
Yes, I hear you.
You laugh.
No, George. It's quite the opposite. It's lovely. So very lovely. Excuse me.
You're crying?
Listen, I'm an emotional man. You write emotional music like that, I cry.
Now, why? What made you cry?
I know something happened here in my heart. George, it's only happened a few times in my life.
After the traditional Boston tryout, Porgy and Bess opened in New York 2 weeks later, October 10th, 1935. The celebrity-filled audience gave the work an ovation that has seldom been equaled. Afterwards, Gershwin and all those involved in the production celebrated at a Park Avenue apartment, with Paul Whiteman's band playing and the cast still singing the score. Everything indicated they had a major hit on their hands. But when the morning papers containing the reviews appeared, one of the show's hit songs... proved tragically prophetic.
Mama's making more coffee.
Yeah, listen to this one. Porgy and Bess does not utilize all the resources of the operatic composer.
That's gentler than the one I'm reading. Such surefire rubbish as the duet between Porgy and Bess. How the composer could stoop to... Well, y'all get the idea.
Yeah. It is crooked folklore and halfway opera. A crippled work.
You know, gentlemen, you're all reading the music critics. I'm sitting here reading one of the drama critics.
More pans?
This one says, I quote, Mr. Gershwin has contributed something glorious to the spirit of Haywood's community legend. It contains some of the loveliest music he has written.
Let me see that.
George, you once told me that the only thing you were sensitive to was a lumpy mattress. Now, was that talk or fact?
DuBose, Stravinsky once said, and I quote, I am a perfectly sure road. There is nothing to discuss or criticize. One does not criticize anyone that is functioning. 20 months, 559 pages of score, 700 pages of orchestration. I guess I wrote a lumpy mattress. At least according to these music critics. It's amazing how wrong they can be. Mama, where's that coffee?
With George Gershwin, it was never truly a matter of ego. It was simply the kind of honest confidence that is so often the lifeblood of genius. It was the kind of confidence enjoyed by Da Vinci, Michelangelo, and George Gershwin. Of course, the critics were wrong. Gershwin and the public were right. The original production lasted for only 124 performances, but the Theater Guild took Porgy and Bess on a national tour the following year. In 1938, it was performed successfully on the West Coast. During World War II, it played in over 50 cities throughout the United States, Canada, and Europe. 17 years after its tryout in Boston, it opened in Vienna, Austria. That company moved to London, Berlin, and Paris. In the following years, it was performed throughout Europe, the Middle East, and Latin America. Its subsequent performances in New York ran more than twice as long as the original. In motion picture form, it was seen in virtually every country on Earth. Of its foreign tours, sponsored by the United States State Department, it has been said, "Our country has not had a better advertisement than the Porgy and Bess troupe. Anytime, anywhere."
After Porgy and Bess opened, at the age of 38, George Gershwin was dead. He was a great man while he lived. Today, 30 years later, somehow he seems even greater.
You have been listening to another portrait from an American gallery. Today, Ross Martin was starred as George Gershwin, composer, in Porgy, Bess, and George. Featured in the cast were Marvin Miller, Olin Soule, and Lou Krugman. Sound patterns by Gene Twombly. Ernie Hughes was the pianist. Porgy, Bess, and George was written by Robert M. Young, produced and directed by William Lally. Art Ballinger speaking. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service.